The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
So thank you everybody for coming. I haven't been here for quite some time and I apologise for that, but sometimes health issues get in the way. I'm much better now, and I hope you're all keeping well and safe. Today I would like to talk about primarily my relationship with my teacher. It is his 40th memorial anniversary, so that is why I'm going to Korea this year. We went for his 30th, and when I say we, I'm talking about a few of the Western students who had trained with him from the early 70s. I arrived in 1979, and he passed away 4 years later, very unfortunately, because he was a very strong and healthy person, but had a stroke which led to his demise. But I recently, the reason for giving this talk, and I have spoken on this before in various ways, is because I had to write a chapter for a book. And I want to speak to some of those verses, some of those paragraphs, where I'm talking about particularly how he taught in a very unteaching way, really, in a, you can say, the non-teaching of the teaching, in a way that was tremendously personal and direct, very unworded, and yet still lives with me till this day. You know, his teaching still guides me every day. And in part, I would touch on some of, well, two of his calligraphies that I have, because each of the things, and I'm sure this is for the other students too, but each of the meetings and things that were offered, I see them as a gift, were offered, were very personal to my need to develop in a certain way. And this will become clearer as I share the teachings. But I want to also begin with talking about how there is a synchronicity, or there is our karmic tendencies that when they align, the conditions to study in go in a certain direction of Buddhism, or to find your teacher unfolds and becomes very present. Now, I started with Theravada Buddhism, so many of you know I was involved with Kantipalo and Ilse Lederman, who became Ayakema, in the founding of What Buddha Dhamma. So I was the young attendant, you might say, the young student who went with them when they first looked at the property. And I was caught in the decision, a little bit in the decision of them getting it, because Ilse was not so keen, given its location. But anyway, whilst I was there for 2 years, we did a lot of building, and many people came and left, but many became monks in Thailand. So teachers you know of, Nyanadhamma, Achanam Nyanadhamma was with us, and many others who are not in robes now, and some still are. But why I came into these grey and brown robes is interesting. While they were going to Thailand to train, I had a dream. I was a monk, but I wasn't in the orange robes or the amber robes. I was in grey robes, and I was a monk. I was a hermit monk going back to my hermitage. And I think I'm still doing that in this very day. But I mentioned this to Kantipalo, my teacher at the time, and he handed me a book called Nine Mountains. And Nine Mountains was written by a monk, a Western monk, who had been with Kantipalo in Thailand and ordained under his teacher. And he found himself in Korea at my temple, at this temple Songgwangsa. And he wrote this book, Nine Mountains. So already there is that connection. So Kantipalo gives me the book, Nine Mountains, which I read. And, you know, it touched me quite deeply because it is about monks who wear grey robes in Korea. And I knew nothing about Korea. But in this interesting line of karmic connections, shortly after, a monk comes to our temple, and he is a Western monk from New Zealand, and he had studied for 5 years at Songgwangsa. Now, this would have been within a month of reading the book, and he had hurt his back, so he was going home, but he offered a retreat. And I did that retreat. And then he said, look, if you have an interest to go to Korea, write to this lady by the name of Suil. And Suil, I thought, I know that name. And I recalled, and I spoke to him about it, I recalled meeting a man who lived very close to me when I was a teacher and living in Fremantle in WA. He lived in the next street. And he told me a story of dying on the streets of Calcutta. And a woman by the name of Suil got him home with her friends. They gathered the funds, got him a passport, got him on the plane, and got him home. So that name was such a strong impression, it stuck in my mind. And as it turned out, the woman I'm writing to, the nun I'm writing to, is the very Suil. So we must never slight in any way on the possibility when connections arise, we should consider them carefully, especially if they repeat. So I then write and I get permission to go, and I, en route to Korea, I visit Thailand and I meet Achan Mahabor. Is it Achan Mahabor? Yes, Achan Mahabor. And many other teachers, wonderful teachers, because I'd studied in the Thai tradition, so I thought I'd better be sure. And if I don't want to be in Korea, I'll come back. So Achan Mahabor said to me when I said I was going to Korea, he said a very interesting thing. I'm not sure what he really meant, but he said, in Thailand, we are trying to discover the diamond and shape it. But the monks in Korea are already polishing it. He said, monks and nuns in Korea are already polishing it. So it is good, you go to Korea. And he sent me to Achan Singtong, and I studied with him a little bit for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then I went on my way to Korea via Japan. I'll read a little excerpt of my journey in Japan. I entered a rohatsu. I entered the Japanese Buddha's Enlightenment retreat at the end of the year. They were quite a severe retreat. Compared to monks in Thailand, they seem to be on steroids. Fast, loud, aggressive, whether eating, walking, talking, or working. I could say that about Koreans too on some level. Rinzai style. The intensity was such, I recall little of it other than snow blowing in through the open window onto my back and gathering on my shoulders. Again, that command, don't move, echoed through the room, and quickly, quickly, when walking. Crack, crack, the sound of sounded throughout the room as mine and other shoulders got a whack. It was actually a relief from the uncomfortable bodily shivers and shakes as the hall was freezing. Now, this was in December, in the mid of winter, late around our Easter time So it seemed a little extreme to think I would go and live and train in Japan, though the opportunities presented themselves as I did go back and train on occasions for a few months in a temple, and still I came back to Korea. So I arrived in Korea and I stayed in a little inn. You know, my journey through Korea was interesting because I ended up getting the very slow train to Suncheon, and every stop, the women in their traditional dress, wide traditional dress, would get on with all their smelly creatures in buckets and their various market produce. And but the schoolgirls were very helpful, and I'd received a lot of the what they call the mochi or the rice cakes. So I gave those to the schoolgirls, but they helped me get on the bus, the last bus to Songgwangsa. And in Songgwangsa, I stayed in a little inn, and very small little inn, and when I asked for a bathroom, I was pointed to the little river at the back to wash, and the toilet was a bucket next to my door, and the room had a hot floor, a very hot floor, with a big thick quilt on it, and my pillow was a block of wood. So I described that in very succinct ways, you know, in my words here on arriving in Korea. And when I came out in the morning, there was a monk waiting in front of the inn, just standing there. He didn't speak. He bowed when he saw me and just ushered me to follow him. And he slowly took me up through the village with all the late autumn colours and the bright orange persimmon dangling from bare trees. It was very beautiful, my recollection of that time of year, the late autumns or even the early autumns are magnificent, but late autumn's quite interesting because it's very stark and you often already have had a cover of snow or the ground is frosted. And we walked up very slowly, and when I entered the gates, I write this: we stopped to bow. My heart was stilled yet joyous. I was home, walking slowly, taking it all in, the old trees, the gnarled pines lining the river, the freshly fallen red and golden deciduous leaves dotted in the path. We stopped to bow again at the tall stone stele. So this is my home temple, and this is my teacher. I think, can I move this up? That's right. Whoops, come back. So these are the tall stone steles that I bowed to, and they're the steles that have the history of the 16 great patriarchs of this temple. Now, this temple is one of three main temples in Korea. They're called the Sambojong, the Buddha temple, the Dharma temple, and the Sangha temple. And this is the Sangha temple because it had many great national masters. And the very first national master was a great monk by the name of Chinil. And Chinil, like Dogen, contemporary with Dogen in Japan, he was a great reformer of Buddhism, and he brought together colleagues, monks, and lay people, and they started a community called the Chonghae-sa community. Chonghae means the Prajna and Samadhi community, the wisdom and calm or cultivating community. And so this grew into, very quickly, a large, over 1,000 monks. We still have the rice bowl, which is half a tree dug out, that they would put the rice in every day for the community of monks and nuns to live. And because of him, then Songgwangsa still has this lineage of great teachers. And my teacher was the last great of this 100 years. And Even my name is on one of the stelae. They must wonder, who's this Australian nun by the name of Jikwang, you know, in centuries to come? But a few of the Western disciples had the name under our teacher with other disciples. So I've bowed to the great national masters, and then I thanked the monk as he took me to the cat compound where I was to meet the nuns. Suil, the nun I spoke of, greeted me with her big smile and took my bags, and with Songil, the French nun, they quickly put me into monastic robes, quickly dressed me in robes, and took me to meet Pangjang's name. Pangjang is just a title. It's the title given to, I think it was only five monks in Korea who were the masters of very large temples that had both the meditation halls and the training monks colleges, the training monks, the sutra monks compound. So Songguangsai had both of those. Also, it had a very well-known and well-respected teacher. So coming back, I was meeting my teacher here. I think it's not going to go back, but anyway, it'll go. There we go. I think I'll let you handle this one, Langdon. can you go back? Yes. So Kusan's Nim was actually a very humble man. He was very small in stature. He was probably my height, if not shorter, but tremendously large in his persona and his mind. His mind was the whole of the temple, as we discovered when he passed away. And this is the entrance to Songguangsa. So I'll share more about him as we go along. In meeting my teacher, he sat behind, it was a wooden table, which was actually the root of a very large tree. And for the years I knew him, and I believe the whole time he'd been there as the Pangjang, that was his table. It always had an orchid on it, sometimes one in flower, sometimes one sitting on a rock, and a small container with some sweets in it, octagonal container, a traditional Korean container that would have little compartments with different sweets. So everyone who came got a little sweet and a cup of tea. So this was my meeting. And the one where he's sort of saying, how tall are you? Well, I was on it. Go back. There we go. I can do this. He made a cup of tea, as he did there, and he talked. I offered him this scarf. So I say here, he said, come and have some tea, in an inviting warm voice. I heard you had arrived. So I followed Songil and Suil, and we bowed, and then I offered him the gifts of honey and nuts and a scarf. I apologized for it being a little bit short. I explained I'd just finished knitting the scarf on the train coming here, but ran out of wool. It was a fine, light grey llama wool, a soft, and he seemed delighted with it. And when he received it, he put the two ends together around his neck and he rolled it three times and he said, Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama, because he heard the word Lama, Dalai Lama, which is quite interesting. And he wore that right up until he died, every autumn and winter and early spring, always had it hanging over his head. And I see it here on this on the table. So he then proceeded to say, well, we don't have time now to cut your hair. Come after lunch. And he offered to cut my hair, which is, from what I heard, no other Western monk or nun had the hair cut on the first day. They used to have to go through a preliminary period. But he cut mine because I think he realized I'd been already training for 2 years in Theravada. And then he invited us to come and have some tea, and he offered some words. And I won't go into this too much here, because I have touched on it, but I will just say, in Korea we have a practice called a Hwadu practice. And the Hwadu practice is a practice where you develop a deep inquiry based on a few words, maybe one word or a few words. In Japan, they talk about a koan or kongan in Korea. We talk about that. It's a story, an old Zen master story. He did less of this. He gave a little story which was about what is alive and what is not alive, or what is a body and what is a mind in different ways. Something has more of a mind or less of a mind, has a body and no mind, such as a corpse, you know. So a series of questions like this. And I answered them pretty rapidly, except for the last one. And he said, what has a complete body and a complete mind? A strong body and a strong mind. And I paused. He didn't wait for an answer. Then he said, this strong body and this strong mind, how does it differ from yours? And I had remembered, I didn't touch on it here, but early in my very first retreat, back in the early 70s in WA, when a teacher, one of the first Buddhist teachers, came to West Australia, if not the first, was a layman by the name of John Coleman and a disciple of Ubar Khin. And in that sort of what they call now Goenka retreats, but an Ubar Khin retreat, I had a deep experience after 3 days. And it had puzzled me very deeply. There was a sense of everything falling away. So this idea or notion of, one, a self or not a self, or, two, even a Buddha in comparison to myself. So when I asked him, if this body and mind are empty, where is the Buddha mind and the body? And he very quickly quipped back, what is this that's asking? Took us straight back into that place of inquiring. And for a moment, I was absorbed in what is this. I was absorbed in this thisness, this. And where the mind, when you have an experience of something in that very present moment situation, such as this moment, this thing, then what happens is the mind becomes very silent, very empty, very still. I think stillness is the concise word. It becomes stilled. And I emptied into this seamlessly spacious thisness of the moment, of the situation. He then sent me off to train with the nuns, sit with the nuns. But as a trainee, you have to be a novice, as in Newbury, when the Western monastic monks and nuns come to the temple. They're a novice for a period. So I had to redo my novitiate. And here you see me washing dishes. You know, I never had a camera, so I don't know where all these pictures have appeared, but somehow over the years they did. And so I spent about 4 months in Songhwangsa, pretty much in the kitchen, still sitting morning and evenings with the nuns and doing other chores, but a lot of work in the kitchen, as you do as a novice. But primarily sitting on the ground, a concrete ground, sometimes with hot water. I was lucky that day. Maybe because the photo was taken. But if you look at the table, it's frozen with ice. So it was very cold. And then I spent 4 months with nuns, So at the nuns' training centre, as you see, all the clothes are often patched at this time. I had to learn to do all the basic training of how to live with other nuns and live in the halls and eat with four bowls. And yes, I think I had a more definitive type of training, a more defined and more... I understood the role better, you might say, than just living with a few nuns in our little room. But during here, I say, as far as my practice goes, this learned to wash the dishes. It learned to chop the vegetables. So this, when I'm saying this, in this moment, chopping, this learned to sew. So the thisness within me, this mind, this presence, it learned to go more deeply into this inquiry. In our small confines, now they're very small, they're only about 4 by 3, 4.5 by 3 at the max. And sometimes we had up to 5 nuns living in there. But usually for the meditation season, there were just two or three of us. So as they were very, confines were small, we learnt respect, to be frugal, was to foster and trusting in one another and harmony between us. We studied temple rules, Confucian thought, Buddhist precepts and language. All this so as to know how to behave in a culture and in this engaged Son Buddhist temple. Or Son Buddhist community. I didn't really learn a lot of language there until I went later to live with the nuns. It says, I had a quick intuition. There were formal and informal greetings, and whenever and wherever two hands were brought together with a bow and a smile in a moment of selfless greeting and recognition. So even now, you know, I'm often, people come, I always bow. But there, you bowed to everything. As soon as you come into a compound, you bowed. When you came out, you bowed. You bowed to the sky and the trees. And you almost walked around with your hands together. Not really, but, you know, that became part of how you lived and how you respected the environment, the people, and the life. So here, as you see, this little compound, and it still is like this, and I still go and stay in this room when I go back to Korea. And we swept a dirt floor, you know. There could not be a single. We would go out in the rainy season and pick out the tiny little sprigs of the weeds coming up, and all the temple is dirt, and you sweep it. But it's quite nice. It's this buffy colour. And the monks go out and sweep all the leaves once a week, the whole temple right down to the entrance, which is quite a long way to the village, is swept. But then also, as you see here, you know, I have someone who's instructing me. Over seven years, 6 nuns from France, Scotland, Canada and Australia and England and Luxembourg were ordained in Songguangsa and lived together in Hwamjeon. Hwamjeon, Hwam is the Avatamsaka Sutta, and it had, in this compound, had woodblock libraries, ancient woodblock libraries. I don't show them here, but they're all carved by hand. So all the texts were rubbings off these woodblocks. So we used to often do rubbings, but usually of pictures, you know, nice pictures of Kuan Yin or the Buddha. Less of the Chinese characters. So we lived over 7 years. I lived there actually for just 5 years. It was an old compound set over the river from a temple. There's another picture of that. And housed 2 dwellings for monastic, 3 halls, the ancient woodblock library. During retreats, 2 to 4 nuns lived and practiced together in the little space of 3 by 4. We kept very little possessions, a few, a seasonal set of robes, a couple of books, writing and sewing material. The rest was stored in a locker, in one fruit box, and one small space for the season's necessities. Everything was patched. The floors, the doors, the old brown bedding, all the material items, even our socks and our undies, were lovingly repaired over and over. When Western monks went home, I gathered their leftover clothes and underpants and socks, boiled and dyed them and wore them, or I stored them for the new novice. We were less indulged, but never poor or wanting, except perhaps for privacy. There was no privacy. I think we had one little door where we could, where our belongings were kept, where we could shut and change clothes. Panjang's Nim and other monks often visited us to give us fruit and treats. The robes came from our nun teachers, and we received them when we went to visit during the free season. My robes now are mostly getting very old, and although I'm quite happy to wear all my patched robes or my old robes, my committee thought I can't necessarily rely on Korea to offer me robes anymore. I've been back a long time. So that is how the robe offering has come. But for myself, not particularly necessary, really. And then we had, so I also, at the end, I did ordain as a novice. After 8 months, 4 months in Songguangsa and 4 months with the nuns. So this was when I was training with my nun teacher in Myeongsong's Nim in Ulmansa. Ulmansa used to have 250 nuns in training. They have less than 100 now, very few. It's the largest training school, so I think the other training schools are disappearing. There were only ever five. But and my nun teacher is 95 this year, and still amazing, still doing calligraphy every day, teaches the senior nuns once a week, and still attends to work and gardens and things. Mm. We meditated 8 to 12 hours during the winter and summer retreats, and usually somewhere between about 6 to 8 in the off season. Even when I first came back, I was sitting 6 to 8 hours a day for many years. A little less now. And we rose at 3 a.m. to the beautiful deep chanting accompanied by the sound of a wooden fish, dong, bong, bong, and other instruments marked time and bells, but time with bells and gongs, beating, ringing, dinging, and booming rhythmically, even to inform us of fires or death. We always knew the big booming bell, if it was ringing rapidly, there was fires. If it was slow, you know, a very slow beat, it's a big stick that hits a great big bell, somebody has passed away. In both cases, we know what to do. In our small room, we meditated. We had a little tiny room next to where we slept. It was about 2 by 2, not very big, and it just fitted 4 cushions in it. But we meditated in there, and in summertime we would sit in the, here we go, we would sit in a little Buddha hall here that was on the compound. There were 4 of us for one winter in 1982 in the snow. I think I'm on the far, I don't know, right or left. Where are we here? That side. And we had our daily and our weekly rituals. We had more informal meals because we couldn't sit and eat with the monks in their compound. Even the Western monks were able to join in with the Korean monks in all the very formal meals. But we went from eating in this very rustic little dining area that I showed where I was washing dishes to actually going into a very large kitchen, which was very nice. They rebuilt the dining area. And my Vinaya master, or our Vinaya master, he lived in the room on the far end. So we were always under scrutiny as to what visitors came and what we were doing. But he would join us and have a light breakfast. We'd often have I'd make a bit of damper, a sort of bread, steamed bread, and we would have condiments that came from home. We'd all ask our parents to send something from home. Often in the post office, they would be emptied in the box. Anything chocolate, you'd get the wrapper. But you would find Vegemite, cheese, smelly cheese. The wrappers were all removed. They decided they didn't like the cheese. Or milk, powdered milk. It would be emptied in the box, you know, quite often. So that was always... little challenges were like this. So that's us sitting in the little hall in summer. There was also, I did go off very early to train in the meditation halls with nuns. And this was not my second or third meditation hall, where I gave a story about a nun who used to have a tiger living nearby. She was the head nun of this hall, extraordinary nun. She was only there for one season that I was there. But I don't know if you can see how close those cushions are. And that's where you sleep, eat, and sit for 3 months. Usually between, in the nun halls, about 14 hours, 14 to 16 hours. And when we do the non-sleep period for 1 week, it's 20 hours you're sitting on that cushion. So it's serious, quite serious practice. You have still only one day, which is our bath day. This picture's slightly in the wrong place, but I'll speak to that later. So bath day was... we'd shave each other's heads, we'd have a lovely hot traditional bath, and then in the afternoon we could have tea, go for walks. This day some visitors arrived. But you can see the rudimentary part of our bathroom areas were very rudimentary. The outside washing areas were rudimentary, and we would wash our clothes there. Oops, back one. And then the next day, so I wrote something. Every 2 weeks, there was a bath day. We shaved each other's heads, and after the scrub, we soaked in the hot tub. We loved that. We don't clean, often stiffly starched cotton robes. Starching, walking, stretching, and folding clothes is an ancient traditional art in Korea. It protects the material, and you could wear it for the next 2 weeks. On the full moon days, monks gathered to recite the Bhikkhu Vinaya, and the nuns, we recited the Patimokkha, or the nuns' Patimokkha, or we, if we weren't a bhikkhuni, we would read about it, we studied it. On the full moon and new moon days, we gathered early to take either the Bodhisattva precepts or the other Vinaya, and in the afternoon, the master Pusen Pangjang's Nim ascended the podium to give a classical Dharma talk. He would pound the table, the floor, and raise his stick and say, "Do you see this?" Pound it. "Can you hear this?" And, you know, it was, if there were a lot of very practiced monks, the room was extremely still and strong. And he would always ask, you know, "Has anybody realized something, or do you understand?" And I only once I did see a few people stand up to debate in a certain way, but one time somebody put their fist through a paper, broke the door completely through the paper door. And it was great excitement, you know, when something like that, everyone starts talking to each other. "Is this for real, you know?" And then there is a little debate between the master to see the depth of that insight. And he's always, you know, he's very strong, as I will touch on in my next little episode. But this was sort of a what you call a rod of truth. The staff is a rod of truth in this tradition. And when he put his hand through the door with great gust, you know, there may be silence, there may be, in this case, there was a debate. And he walked out. He did that and he walked out. So we can only assume that there was a lot of conversation went on afterwards, Dharma conversation. Then Snim would begin his sermon in a classical way, and he'd say, this monk's view, he'd read a text or read a poem or read something that has to do about a practice, and then he would, if he disagreed, he would say, this monk's view on this. And he would say what his opinion is. You know, it could be quite different to what's been written in text for 1,000 years. And then he would share some passages from Mahayana or Chan texts and talk about the Huado. And he would finish with admonishment. Sometimes you must practice hard. You've only got this opportunity. You know, never know when you're going to pass away or not be able to practice. And then he would finish with very sort of encouraging words, you know, like a famous encouragement would be to how to grow great faith, and great determination, and what we call is doubt, not skeptical doubt, but a deep, deep practiced inquiry. So he would teach in certain ways every week, always with beautiful poetries, and I'll touch on one of those. Anyway, after that, we were invited. Now, I don't know if this next one's to do with this, maybe not. Yes, we were invited to go and have tea, and he would, with the translator, so Song Il in the with a black scarf, she was one of our main translators at that time. Several had left. And I don't have a picture of all of us in the room, but this is another occasion where the nuns were with him. But we would sit there and he would go through his lecture and Song Il would translate, because we really understood it. It was too traditional in language, Chinese language, we didn't really understand. But this is an interesting little chapter, so let me read it. I just thank the wonderful translators. We gained great comprehension and insight into the essentials of his talk. Then suddenly a German monk by the name of Hagyong asked the master, is that, pointing to his hand, the hand of a Buddha? And without a second thought, Kusan Snim's foot shot to just short of his nose. He had a little foot, little leg, but it was just far enough to come right in front of his nose. It was so fast, we all, it's that sort of little confrontation, we all sat bolt upright as if it was hitting our nose. And, you know, you sort of become like one in an environment like this, you know. Our minds like one. And then he was about to grab his horse whip, which he had a sort of horse whip on the wall, and his eyes were fixed on Hagong as if he was fixed on ours. We were all fixed on him. And he quickly said, don't pretend to know something or just to be clever. Say something just to be clever. Don't inquire about things that are not useful for your practice or chat about superfluous matters. Don't mimic a master by making gestures like raising the eyebrows or lifting the fist unless you have something genuine to say, you've had a genuine experience, or you have broken through the great doubt. These are all senseless gimmicks, he continues. I can see, even if you don't open your mouth or blink an eye, whether your practice has ripened. So I really learnt a very important thing. which I've reflected on many a time, and I have noticed, you know, in some of the Zen traditions, there is so much of this show. Actually, they're trained to show, but the depth, the inside wisdom isn't ripened yet. The inside awakening is not there. So the inside is not matching the words and the gimmick. So I want to talk about a couple of things where I learned a big lesson, and partially from my teachers. You know, he never, as I said, he'd never spoke a lot, but there were inferences that in communication you knew exactly what you had to do next. And one season we had finished the retreat, a summer retreat, and the Westerners had all quickly, the temple empties. The next day it's emptied. The visiting monks have gone and the Western monks have gone somewhere. But I was still there. We had a visitor. And so I went and asked Kusan's name. I went and bowed and asked him, can I take this visitor to visit a nearby temple over the mountain? And he said to me, he was basically encouraging me to stay and cultivate because the temple was very quiet and it was empty. He said, this is a good time to continue your practice. You've worked very hard. If you stay, something might happen. Anyway, the next morning I did go. I bowed. I was so stubborn, so determined to go on my walk and take this lady. I couldn't see. Everyone else has left. Why can't I? The next morning he came, because he used to often come to take us to the field to do some work. And this day there was a cow ploughing in the field with a little calf. And he didn't say anything, I just followed him. And we were throwing rocks as the plough was going through, hoeing the ground. We were throwing the little rocks out of the field for the new planting. And I said something to him, he didn't say anything. He squatted down and he put his fist out like that. And the little calf came running up to it. And they're butting like this. And I was very amused by this sort of head to fist. Who's the stronger, you know, with this little calf. And then he glanced up at me and I knew what he was doing. This was my own butting determined mind. So I wrote, still harboring some guilt and conflicting thoughts. So I was still thinking I was in the right, but, you know, I was at the same time, because I came back from the walk feeling very tired and I didn't do any practice. Said to him I'd practice, but I didn't. And I was still harboring these thoughts. I toughened my resolve and sat facing two newly papered lattice doors in our little hall till late afternoon. The bright midday light filtered through the paper, leaving not a speck unnoticed in the room. Brightness, however, soon turned into the late afternoon soft glow. This butting-headed mind, too, had softened. Suddenly, my attention fell on one tiny, less-lit square in the door. As suddenly the sound, tuck, tuck, transfixed my gaze on that spot, and the third, tuck, pierced through those layers between us. As the tiny black beak retracted, we met eye to eye in that shiny black hole, again bound by trust in this. This followed through that tiny perforation, and I felt universal light illuminate my whole being. Elated and feeling so alive, I quickly went to Samalam to share my experience of the thisness with my teacher and to apologize. He had left too. There was quite a number of occasions I wanted to say something, but he was gone. Well, the teacher was gone. Another incident in the fields. As I said, we often went to the fields with Kusan to throw away rocks or sometimes to take the little insects off the new fresh leaves and put them in jars and rehouse them. I don't know how they like their rehousing, but we did that quite often. I think they just all flew back the next day, really. But anyway, there was attempts. Again, he didn't really have many explanations for his actions, but we began to observe more with attentiveness and how his body language of this was enacting the moment. He grabbed a handful of fresh barley stalks and, I've missed something here. Crouching over a small coal, we wondered in anticipation. He was making a little fire. And with open attentiveness and the body and mind engaged in what was happening, he grabbed a handful of fresh green barley stalks, and by rubbing them in his hands, the seeds sprinkled over the coals. Running a thin stick through the barley, over the barley and through the coals, he was turning these sort of roasted little balls over and over in the last sparks of the dying embers and merging moments of our eyes piercing as one, looking as one, looking in this situation as one, gazed on the charred roasted barley rolling through the ashes and hot grains. Then he sifted the ash from the grain and he rolled them between his strong open hands and gently blew away the ash and the charred husk of the barley. The golden brown beads were then carefully funneled into small piles in our eager open hands. Blowing and chewing each tiny morsel of sweet roasted bud left to such wordless joy. When we enter fully into the complexity of each activity, we leave, as in this case, lost for words of the taste. How do you describe the taste of freshly roasted barley in the fields freed of rocks? Infinite moments of just this action, where we enter and leave as one. Snim laughed, we all laughed heartily. The taste of insight arising is just the taste of no taste. I forgot to give you the picture of it. This is Kusan Snim. I'm probably just behind him. And this is the walk from the temple up to our compound, up through the snow, over the snowy rocks, where I think we slipped in once or twice, but not very often. And they did later put a wooden plank. So this is quite early on. This is a calligraphy of, in my paper, there's about three calligraphies I have. The first one I'll just talk about very briefly. Snim's one-stroke Bodhidharma hangs on a wall. It supposedly is me in meditation with the exaggerated shape of my head. They always had this thing about I have protrusion in the front and at the back. So they do this whenever they used to do this. and so he did a Bodhidharma of me and two other nuns. We all had, one had a big nose and the other one had a halo. The Suhail had the halo. And I had this very interesting shaped head. Anyway, so it's me in meditation. And it says, the verse says, sit as the smoke of burning incense as it enters into the fragrance, enters into its fragrance. Watching incense smoke arise, I enter more deeply into the pervading thisness of my huadu. A thin stream of smoke rises straight and strong before tapering off and entering its fragrance. But when a thought arises, it wavers and circles again and again before it fades, leaving no fragrance. Takes a little while to... That's my little verse at the end. When I sit I sometimes open my eyes and the incense is straight and strong. As soon as I have that recognition, it starts to waver and turn, and that moment's gone. You know, so it's a matter of how do you see without adding anything to it? How do you do something without adding anything? Now, this one is patience. I've long pondered on why a knife is above a heart. So that character at the top is a knife, and the character below is the character for heart. A deity, the knife and a sword are symbols of wisdom in Buddhism. A deity wielding a wisdom sword slices away ignorance in a single blow, exposing the infinite compassion of the nature within us. Also, it is a symbol of skillful means, such as the tools held in the hands of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. These are useful aids to protect, teach, sever, and penetrate deeply into our hearts, alleviating painful karmic obstructions. So the tools of Dhamma, the tools of practice, the tools of teachings, these are all things that we can use to cultivate our body and our mind. They're skillful mean tools. However, not being endowed with the skillfulness of a surgeon, at times my knife is too heavy, too sharp, too blunt. It's been said, patience is the most difficult parameter to perfect. I'm grateful my teacher's calligraphy still inspires this deep contemplation. So, coming towards, there's this little thing happened just shortly before my teacher becomes very ill, and he's just showing he is quite sick here. Song Kwang Sa was changing as new structures were replaced with the old buildings. An old building was to be rebuilt for the nuns on an old hermitage site. One afternoon, Kusan Snim asked me and Song Il Snim to bring a shovel and follow him. He led us up a narrow track behind the compound, our compound, to a large ancient rock wall. I knew this spot well, as I'd often sat in the small cypress grove above the wall. This site hadn't been inhabited for over 500 years, but for some reason Snim asked me to dig in a couple of damp spots. Tree roots were inhibiting the effort. Then suddenly Snim looked tired. He requested I carry him down the mountain. A rather unthinkable thing, but anyway, given the circumstances, with the help of Song Il, I got him on my back and seated him on the shovel, and then slowly descended back to Samilam, his room, where I prepared a basin of warm water and washed his feet, and then helped with his attendant to take him inside. Sadly, it was clear our teacher's vigor was waning. Unfortunately, Snim didn't get to see the nun's hermitage built. Without his knowledge of feng shui and the building skills, it was not as he envisaged or requested. Still, it was a sturdy traditional building that suited my purpose for many years and a tranquil retreat. I called it the Moon Seal, or the Seal of the Moon, in Walam. From teaching, it's from a teaching called the Ocean Samadhi in the Avatamsaka. In Walam was my home for about 14 years. I did come and go. I went and did retreats, and occasionally other monks would come in for 3 months. And I came back once to Australia, I think, or twice. But it was my home. I still engaged with the main temple and the monastic daily and commuted as needed. It was an enriching and important chapter in my life at Song Kwang Sa. When I left, I passed it on to Wonsung Snim, a respected sutra teacher and translator of old text. In 1998, the hermit's life followed me back to Australia. So, moon mind, sun mind, I can see time's waltzing on. Oh, be patient, we're nearly there. My teacher asked me after this occasion, so this was Inwalam, and that's me sitting on my own many a day. My teacher was dying, yes. So in 1983, in the autumn free season, when only a few meditation monks were resident, he asked if I could attend him. He had two attendants, but my job was to help take him for walks, because he still went to look at the construction around the temple, to help him with exercise, and on the full moon night, to with his attendant, he would sit all night. So to sit with him and then help the attendant take him out into the courtyard. So we would go out and he would breathe in the full moon. He'd do this exercise, he taught me to breathe in the full moon. And I asked him after this little exercise, is moon mind or sun mind better? I'd had some intuition in my very first retreat that the experience was more a sun mind illuminative experience. But as I practiced more, I noticed my mind was more a softer sort of light or soft luminosity. So I asked if moon mind or sun mind. He paused, which is very rare. He paused and he said, with quite an intent look, sun mind. That added more curiosity in me. Sun mind. Why did he say sun mind? And these are one of the things that over years you come to understand. Many years later, I understood. Because I probably would have said both, given different context. But there was a hesitation, but no elaboration. The notion of sun-like mind, as I mentioned, from an earlier dissolution experience of body and self, was very luminous. Yet years later, contemplating how sun reflected off the moon's surface, creating moonlight. Now that's something from science that I learned years later. The sun reflects off the earth and creates the luminosity we see in a moonlight. And I had this memory of this conversation with Kusan Snim, and I suddenly realized why sun mind is primary. It is the sun mind in a state of deep, it's the sun's mind is better in a state of deep concentration. Moon mind's luminosity, that calm meditative mind, is but a reflection of the rays perceived through the sun mind's wisdom. It's only through the wisdom, the light of the wisdom, that we have that moon-like luminosity of the mind. Wisdom creates conditions for moon mind's luminous, inquisitive, alluring embrace. So all the experiences that come from a softening of the mind is from this. Then there's a calligraphy, I don't know if you know an Enzo, there's a round circle, empty circle in Zen. Talked about a lot in Japanese Zen. And the empty circle, he gave me a calligraphy, is like a flower at the top. And the core in the center is empty. And I write here, in Imoko, which is my meditative practice of the enlightenment circle, the appearance of the luminance arises from its essence, which is the moon mind. The essence is your moon. And the function is the fullness within the emptiness, which is the sun mind, the karmic seeds of potential that radiate out of this core, this essential moon mind. So this is the karma is what is essentially there in the fundamental core of our mind, or foundation. We have another word, is foundation. As community was preparing for winter retreat and travelling, Son monks were arriving to sit 3 months in the hall. I too was preparing to leave. Kusan's Nim had encouraged me to spend the retreat with a nun we both knew. As his health seemed to be getting stronger, I agreed. When I was bowing, he presented me with a container of green tea. It was actually a big container with a little thing of green tea, but it was so delicious. It was very fresh, newly made green tea. My parting words: I had just settled into my practice. So this was the last time I saw him. I just settled in my practice when a call came to inform me Kusan Pangjang Nim's health was declining. Normally during a retreat, there's no travelling was permitted unless you're sick or there is an urgent family business. It was early evening when I entered Kusan Nim's room. I bowed slowly and offered my concerned regards to his attendants and sat near him. Snim looked comfortable. I observed his strong breathing and gentle snore. As I spoke, his breathing became quieter and very smooth, as if he was listening. I thanked him for his compassionate care and guidance and vowed to stay a nun and continue my practice. I mentioned my retreat was going well. This is the nun I was having a retreat with. Lost my spot. Going well. Then spoke of a dream I'd had the previous night. I said we were travelling on a path together when at a fork you pointed and said, "You go that way. We'll meet again." I asked him, "Can't I come with you?" He simply said, "Go well." Holding back my tears, I offered these parting words. This morning I saw three white roses bud, three white roses buds about to bloom. It was snowing. They were now sitting together with me in a vase. Wiping away tears, I bowed slowly and slipped out into the dark. Though sad, my heart was full of gratitude for the kindness and teachings he had shared these few years. The three white roses remained, one still in bud throughout the winter retreat. I had noticed at his memorial, Kusan Nim's orchids had all bloomed in the chill of winter. At the funeral, so we're coming to the end now. It was a massive funeral, really, at that time in 79. I came back, and that was me with the nuns, and we would sit with other disciples near his body and welcome the visitors who came to bow, and then he was put in a big hall, and thousands of people came over the week. And then on that Memorial Day, great Son masters, monks and nuns, hundreds of lay followers filled Son Quang Sa. We all followed the golden chrysanthemum-covered casket, carrying colourful banners with words written from the heart. The parade streamed down through the village to the sound of Namu Amitabha, Namu Amitabha, an upper hill where preparations for the cremation awaited. Long fire sticks, so different leaders put in long fire sticks into the corners of the pyre. So you can't really see it there, but they're that's the fire. I think it's a bit fancier these days. And they would shout, "Snim, Snim, leave your body now, the fire is burning. Come back swiftly," reverberated through the crowds. It's normal, we chant various things like this and chants, but we ask them to come back and continue to teach us. As the fire slowly burnt through the misty night, Western disciples huddled together around the smouldering pyre, reminiscing. We shared our loving thoughts about this spiritual fatherly figure who had transformed our lives. Khusan Snim gave his last most important teaching that night. As his body returned to ash, somebody uttered these words, "Can you understand now? Originally, there is no birth or death." It's quite interesting, just this voice boomed out from a Westerner. Beautiful rainbow bones, pearl speckled teeth. The interesting thing, they've got the teeth here, they're all covered in like pearls. And that was because he always made his own toothpaste out of pine gum and this jugyom, this salt. Salt burnt in bamboo seven or nine times, and crushed up, and he would make it with the gum and rub his teeth every day. So it produced these pearls on his teeth. We crushed some of the bones in the roofing tiles and together with the ash put them in small white parcels or pouches. We scattered them on Mount Chogi. Missed one here. Can I go back there, Langdon? Oh, maybe I don't have it. Okay. Oh, no, so it's jumping a bit. No, don't have it. So there was a lovely picture of all of us taking these little parcels and scattering them. He had a hermitage in this place. And because he kept wanting to go back and meditate in the hermitages, the monks went and burnt it to keep him in the main temple. That was many years before I came. But that was his favourite place, so we scattered the ashes there. We found dozens of saria and rainbow-coloured bones in the ashes. Actually, it was my job. After we, as a group, went through and found these relics, and they're in this little tray, I was asked to go and re-sift. So for a few days before his cremation, I went back into the oldest room in the temple. There was a big staff that's passed down from the masters there. Somewhere I've got a picture of me holding it. And I re-sifted through all the ashes, and I found about 200. They're very small, but beautiful. Blood, sari, blue, black, you know, all tiny little things. Some of them, a couple of them were quite big. Yeah. And these coloured relics and bones were given to the abbot, who later interned them in Khusan Snim's pagoda. It consoled me to observe how all the monks at Songkhwangsa were so brotherly and caring for each other and of us foreign monks, foreign monastic. So that is the story of my teacher. It's a little long, and I'm sorry. You're a little tired, I'm sure. But I'm sure you get the point about, I mean, this isn't all, there's a little bit more with this chapter, and it's becoming a book, so one day you can read the book. But I'm sure you get the main point about, you don't need a lot of words. Here I'm giving a lot of words. I wish I could be a one-line, one-word teacher. Occasionally it happens, but when you live with a teacher and you live in a compound or in a monastery where people are practicing every day, then you have the capacity to have a deep relationship with that teacher that's unspoken, through the actions, through the good intentions. And the teachers, everyone became teachers. My nun sisters were my teachers. The monks were my teachers. Every time I bowed to someone, I knew by bowing whether my mind was good or not. Just looking at their face. We would bow, we'd look at each other in the eyes, unless we're deep in a samadhi and we'd just sort of do this and continue walking. But we always could see ourselves in the other. So, I don't know if there's much time. I'll give you one or two questions if there really is, and I'll be very brief. No time. Gone. You've had enough anyway, I think. So this will all be clipped off, I'm sure. But thank you for staying with this, and I hope it is of benefit. And please find great preciousness in your relationship with your teachers. Thank you. And there is lunch, so come and share lunch. And if you have any questions, after lunch is a great time. Good. Hello, Michael.